George Angelfield fell into a decline. He locked himself in the library and refused point-blank to come out. This might seem excessive. 10 years of marriage is usually enough to cure marital affection, but Angelfield was an odd fellow, and there it was. He had loved his wife, his ill-tempered, lazy, selfish, and pretty Mathilde. He had loved her more than he loved his horses, more even than his dog. As for their son, Charlie, a boy of 9, it never entered George's head to wonder whether he loved him more or less than Mathilde, for the fact was, he never thought of Charlie at all. Bereaved, driven half mad with grief, George Angelfield sat all day in the library, eating nothing, seeing no one. And he spent his nights there, too, on the daybed, not sleeping, but staring red-eyed at the moon. This went on for months. His pale cheeks became paler. He grew thin. He stopped speaking. Specialists were called from London. The vicar came and left again. The dog pined away from want of affection, and when it died, George Angelfield barely noticed. In the end, the missus got fed up with it all. She picked up baby Isabel from the crib in the nursery and took her downstairs. She strode past the butler, ignoring his protestations, and went into the library without knocking. Up to the desk she marched, and she plumped the baby down in George Angelfield's arms without a word. Then she turned her back and walked out, slamming the door behind her. The butler made to go in, thinking to retrieve the infant. But the missus raised her finger and hissed, "Don't you dare!" He was so startled that he obeyed. The household servants gathered outside the library door, looking at one another, not knowing what to do. But the force of the missus's conviction held them paralysed, and they did nothing. It was a long afternoon, and at the end of it, one of the under-housemaids ran to the nursery. "He's come out! The master's come out!" At her normal pace and in her normal manner, the missus came downstairs to hear what had happened. The servants had stood about in the hall for hours, listening at the door and peeking through the keyhole. At first, their master just sat there, looking at the baby with a dull and perplexed expression on his face. The baby wriggled and gurgled. When George Angelfield was heard cooing and chuckling in response, the servants exchanged looks of astonishment, but they were more astonished later to hear lullabies. The baby slept, and there was silence. Her father, the servants reported, did not once take his eyes from his daughter's face. Then she awoke, hungry, and set to crying. Her shrieks rose in intensity and pitch until finally the door was flung open. There stood my grandfather with his baby in his arms. Seeing his servants standing idly about, he glared at them, and his voice boomed out, "Is a baby left to starve in this house?" From that day on, George Angelfield took personal charge of his daughter. He fed her, bathed her and the rest, moved her cot into his room in case she cried of loneliness in the night, fashioned a papoose so that he could take her riding, read to her, business letters, the sports pages and romantic novels, and shared all his thoughts and plans with her. He behaved, in short, as though Isabel was a sensible, pleasant companion and not a wild and ignorant child. Perhaps it was her looks that made her father love her. Charlie, the neglected older child, 9 years Isabel senior, was his father's son, a lumpen, pasty, carrot-topped boy, with heavy feet and a slow expression. But Isabel inherited her looks from both her parents. The ginger hair shared by her father and brother was burnished in the girl child to a rich, glossy auburn. In her, the pale Angelfield complexion was stretched over fine French bones. She had the better chin from the father's side and the better mouth from the mother's. She had Mathilde's slanting eyes and long lashes, and when they lifted, it was to reveal the astonishing emerald irises that were the emblem of the Angelfields. She was, physically at least, perfection itself. The household adapted to the unusual state of affairs. They lived with the unspoken agreement to behave as though it were entirely normal for a father to dote on his baby daughter. It was not to be considered unmanly, ungentlemanly, or ridiculous that he kept her constantly by him. But what about Charlie, the baby's brother? He was a slow-witted boy, whose mind turned in circles around his few obsessions and preoccupations, but who could not be prevailed upon to learn new ideas or think logically. He ignored the baby and welcomed the changes her arrival introduced to the household. Before Isabel, there had been two parents to whom the missus might report instances of bad behaviour, two parents whose reactions were impossible to foresee. His mother had been an inconsistent disciplinarian, sometimes having him spanked for bad behaviour, at other times merely laughing. His father, although stern, was distracted, and the punishments he intended were frequently forgotten. Catching sight of the boy, though, he would have the vague sense that there might be some misdemeanour to correct, and he would spank the child, thinking that if it wasn't actually owed, it would do in advance for the next time. This taught the boy a good lesson. He stayed out of the way of his father. With the coming of the baby Isabel, all this changed. Mama was gone, and Papa as good as, too busy with his little Isabel to concern himself with hysterical reports from housemaids about mice roasted with the Sunday joint or pins pressed by malicious hands deep into the soap. Charlie was free to do as he pleased, and what pleased him was removing floorboards at the top of the attic stairs and watching the housemaids tumble down and sprain their ankles. The missus could scold, but then she was only the missus, and in this new, free life, he could maim and wound to his heart's content, in the certain knowledge that he would get away with it. Consistent adult behaviour is said to be good for children, and consistent neglect certainly suited this child. For in these early days of semi-orphanhood, Charlie Angelfield was as happy as the day is long. George Angelfield's adoration of his daughter persisted through all the trials a child can inflict on a parent. When she started to talk, he discovered her to be preternaturally gifted, a veritable oracle, and he began to consult her on everything, until the household came to be run according to the caprices of a 3-year-old child. Visitors were rare, and as the household descended from eccentricity into chaos, they became rarer. Then the servants began to complain among themselves. The butler had left before the child was 2. Cook put up for a year longer with the irregular meal times that the child demanded. Then the day came when she too handed in her notice. When she left, she took the kitchen girl with her, and in the end it was left to the missus to ensure the provision of cake and jelly at odd hours. The housemaids felt under no obligation to occupy themselves with chores. Not unreasonably, they believed that their small salaries barely compensated them for the cuts and bruises, sprained ankles and stomach upsets they incurred owing to Charlie's sadistic experiments. They left and were replaced by a succession of temporary help, none of whom lasted long. Finally, even the temporary help was dispensed with. By the time Isabel was 5, the household had shrunk to George Angelfield, the 2 children, the missus, the gardener, and the gamekeeper. The dog was dead, and the cats, fearful of Charlie, kept outdoors, taking refuge in the garden shed when the weather turned cold. If George Angelfield noticed their isolation, their domestic squalor, he did not regret it. He had Isabel. He was happy. If anyone missed the servants, it was Charlie. Without them, he was lost for subjects for his experiments. When he was scouting around for someone to hurt, his eye fell, as it was bound sooner or later to do, on his sister. He couldn't afford to make her cry in the presence of his father, and since she rarely left her father's side, Charlie was faced with a difficulty. How to get her away? By enticement. Whispering promises of magic and surprise, Charlie led Isabel out of the side door, along one end of the knot garden, between the long borders, out through the topiary garden, and along the beech avenue to the woods. There was a place Charlie knew. An old hovel, dank and windowless. A good place for secrets. What Charlie was after was a victim, and his sister, walking behind him, smaller, younger, and weaker, must have seemed ideal. But she was odd, and she was clever, and things did not turn out exactly as he expected. Charlie pulled his sister's sleeve up and drew a piece of wire, orange with rust, along the white inside of her forearm. She stared at the red beads of blood that were welling up along the livid line, then turned her gaze upon him. Her green eyes were wide with surprise and something like pleasure. When she put out her hand for the wire, he gave it to her automatically. She pulled up her other sleeve, punctured the skin, and with application drew the wire down almost to her wrist. Her cut was deeper than the one he had given her, and the blood rose up at once and trickled. She gave a sigh of satisfaction as she looked at it, and then licked the blood away. Then she offered the wire back to him, and motioned to him to pull up his sleeve. Charlie was bewildered. But he dug the wire into his arm because she wanted it, and he laughed through the pain. Instead of a victim, Charlie had found himself the strangest of conspirators. Life went on for the Angelfields, sans parties, sans hunt meetings, sans housemaids, and sans most of the things the people of their class took for granted in those days. They turned their backs on their neighbours, allowed their estate to be managed by the tenants, and depended on the goodwill and honesty of the missus and the gardener for those day-to-day transactions with the world that were necessary for survival. George Angelfield forgot about the world, and for a time the world forgot about him. And then they remembered him. It was to do with money. There were other large houses in the vicinity, other more or less aristocratic families. Among them was a man who took great care of his money. He sought out the best advice, invested large sums where wisdom dictated, and speculated small sums where the risk of loss was greater but the profit, in the case of success, high. The large sums he lost completely. The small ones went up, moderately. He found himself in a pickle. In addition, he had a lazy, spendthrift son and a goggle-eyed, thick-ankled daughter. Something had to be done. George Angelfield never saw anyone, hence he was never offered financial tips. When his lawyer sent him recommendations, he ignored them, and when his bank sent him letters, he did not write back. As a consequence of this, the Angelfield money, instead of expending itself chasing one deal after another, lounged in its bank vault and grew fat. Money talks. Word got out. "Doesn't George Angelfield have a son?" asked the wife of the near-bankrupt. "How old would he be now, 26? And if not the son for their Sibylla, then why not the girl for Roland?" thought the wife. "She must be reaching a marriageable age by now, and the father was known to dote on her. She would not come empty-handed." "Nice weather for a picnic," she said. And her husband, in the way of husbands, did not see the connection. The invitation languished for a fortnight on the drawing-room windowsill, and it might have remained there until the sun bleached the colour out of the ink, had it not been for Isabel. One afternoon, at a loss for something to do, she came down the stairs, puffed out her cheeks in boredom, picked the letter up and opened it. "What's that?" said Charlie. "Invitation," she said, "to a picnic." "A picnic?" Charlie's mind turned it over. It seemed strange, but he shrugged and forgot it. Isabel stood up and went to the door. "Where are you going?" "To my room." Charlie made to follow her, but she stopped him. "Leave me alone," she said. "I'm not in the mood." He complained, took a handful of her hair, and ran his fingers over the nape of her neck, finding the bruises he had made last time. But she twisted away from him, ran upstairs and locked the door. An hour later, hearing her come down the stairs, he went to the doorway. "Come to the library with me," he asked her. "No." "Then come to the deer park." "No." He noticed that she had changed her clothes. "What do you look like that for?" he said. "You look stupid." She was wearing a summer dress that had belonged to their mother, made of a flimsy white material and trimmed with green. Instead of her usual tennis shoes with their frayed laces, she had put on a pair of green satin sandals a size too big, also their mother's, and had attached a flower in her hair with a comb. She had lipstick on. His heart darkened. "Where are you going?" he asked. "To the picnic." He grabbed her by the arm, dug his fingers in, and pulled her toward the library. "No!" He pulled her harder. She hissed at him. "Charlie, I said no!" He let her go. When she said no like that, he knew it meant no. He had found that out in the past. She could be in a bad temper for days. She turned her back on him and opened the front door. Full of anger, Charlie looked for something to hit. But he had already broken everything that was breakable. The things that were left would do more harm to his knuckles than he could do to them. His fist slackened. He followed Isabel out of the door and to the picnic. The young people at the lakeside made a pretty picture from a distance, in their summer frocks and white shirts. The glasses they held were filled with a liquid that sparkled in the sunlight, and the grass at their feet looked soft enough to go barefoot. In reality, the picnickers were sweltering beneath their clothes, the champagne was warm, and if anyone had thought to take their shoes off, they would have had to walk through goose droppings. Still, they were willing to feign jollity, in the hope that their pretense would encourage the real thing. A young man at the edge of the crowd caught sight of movement up near the house. A girl in a strange outfit, accompanied by a lump of a man. There was something about her. He failed to respond to his companion's joke. The companion looked to see what had caught his attention and fell silent in turn. A group of young women, eternally alert to the doings of young men, even when the young men are behind their backs, turned to see what had caused the sudden silence. And there followed a sort of ripple effect, whereby the entire party turned to face the newcomers, and seeing them, were struck dumb. Across the wide lawn walked Isabel. She neared the group. It parted for her as the sea parted for Moses, and she walked straight through it to the lake edge. She stood on a flat rock that jutted out over the water. Someone came toward her with a glass and a bottle, but she waved them away. The sun was bright. It had been a long walk, and it would take more than champagne to cool her down. She took off her shoes, hung them in a tree, and, arms outstretched, let herself fall into the water. The crowd gasped, and when she rose to the surface, water streaming from her form in ways that recalled the birth of Venus, they gasped again. This plunge into the water was another thing people remembered years later, after she left home for the second time. They remembered and shook their heads in a mix of pity and condemnation. The girl had had it in her all that time. But on the day it was put down to sheer high spirits, and people were grateful to her. Single-handedly, Isabel brought the whole party to life. One of the young men, the boldest, with fair hair and a loud laugh, kicked off his shoes, removed his tie, and leapt into the lake with her. A trio of his friends followed. In no time at all, the young men were all in the water, diving, calling, shouting, and outdoing one another in athleticism and splash. Thinking quickly, the girls saw there was only one way to go. They hung their sandals in the branches, put on their most excited faces, and splashed into the water, uttering cries that they hoped would sound abandoned, while doing their utmost to prevent any excessive dampening of their hair. Their efforts were in vain. The men had eyes only for Isabel. Charlie did not follow his sister into the water. He stood a little farther off and watched. With his red hair and his pallor, he was a man made for rain and indoor pursuits. His face had gone pink in the sun, and his eyes stung as the sweat from his brow ran into them. But he hardly blinked. He could not bear to take his eyes off Isabel. How many hours later was it that he found himself with her again? It seemed an eternity. Enlivened by Isabel's presence, the picnic went on much longer than anybody had expected, and yet it seemed to the other guests to have passed in a flash, and they would all have stayed longer if they could. The party broke up with consoling thoughts of other picnics to come, a round of promised invitations and damp kisses. When Charlie approached her, Isabel had a young man's jacket arranged around her shoulders, and the young man himself in the palm of her hand. Not far off, a girl loitered, uncertain whether her presence was wanted. Though she was plump, plain, and female, the resemblance she nonetheless bore to the young man made it clear she was his sister. "Come on," Charlie said roughly to his sister. "So soon? I thought we might go for a walk, with Roland and Sibylla." She smiled graciously at Roland's sister, and Sibylla, surprised at the unexpected kindness, beamed back. Charlie could get his own way with Isabel at home, sometimes, by hurting her, but in public he didn't dare, and so he buckled under. What happened during that walk? There were no witnesses to the events that took place in the forest. For want of witnesses, there was no gossip. At least, not at first. But one does not have to be a genius to deduce from later events what took place under the canopy of summer foliage that evening. It would have been something like this. Isabel would have found some pretext for sending the men away.
My shoes, I left them in the tree.
And she'd have sent Roland to fetch them, and Charlie too, for a shawl of Sibylla's or some other item. The girls settled themselves on a patch of soft ground. In the men's absence, they waited in the growing darkness, drowsy for champagne, breathing in the remains of the sun's heat, and with it the beginning of something darker, the forest and the night. The warmth of their bodies began to drive the moisture from their dresses, and as the folds of fabric dried, they detached themselves from the flesh beneath and tickled. Isabel knew what she wanted. Time alone with Roland. But to get it, she had to be rid of her brother. She began to talk while they lolled back against a tree.
"So which is your bow, then?"
"I don't really have a bow," Sibylla admitted.
"But you should."
Isabel rolled on her side, took the feathery leaf of a fern, and let it run over her lips. Then she let it run over the lips of her companion.
"That tickles," Sibylla murmured.
Isabel did it again. Sibylla smiled, eyes half shut, and did not stop her when Isabel ran the soft leaf down her neck and around the neckline of her dress, paying special attention to the swell of the breasts. Sibylla emitted a semi-nasal giggle. When the leaf ran down to her waist and beyond, Sibylla opened her eyes.
"You've stopped," she complained.
"I haven't," said Isabel. "It's just that you can't feel it through your dress."
And she pulled up the hem of Sibylla's dress and played the fronds along her ankles.
"Better?"
Sibylla reclosed her eyes. From the somewhat thick ankle, the green plume found its way to a distinctly chunky knee. An adenoidal murmur escaped from between Sibylla's lips, though she did not stir until the fronds came to the very top of her legs. And she did not sigh until Isabel replaced the greenery with her own tender fingers. Isabel's sharp eyes did not once leave the face of the older girl, and the moment the girl's eyelids gave the first hint of a flicker, she drew her hand away.
"Of course," she said, very matter-of-fact. "It's a bow you need, really."
Sibylla, roused unwillingly from her incomplete rapture, was slow to catch on.
"For the tickling,"
Isabel had to explain.
"It's much better with a bow."
And when Sibylla asked her newfound friend,
"How do you know?"
Isabel had the answer all ready.
"Charlie."
By the time the boys returned, shoes and shawl in hand, Isabel had achieved her purpose. Sibylla, a certain dishevelment apparent in her skirt and petticoat, regarded Charlie with an expression of warm interest. Charlie, indifferent to the scrutiny, was looking at Isabel.
"Have you thought how similar Isabel and Sibylla are?"
Isabel said carelessly.
Charlie glared. "The sounds of the names, I mean. Almost interchangeable, wouldn't you say?"
She sent a sharp glance at her brother, forcing him to understand.
"Roland and I are going to walk a bit farther, but Sibylla's tired. You stay with her."
Isabel took Roland's arm. Charlie looked coldly at Sibylla, registered the disarrangement of her dress.
She stared back at him, eyes wide, mouth slightly open. When he turned back to where Isabel had been, she was already gone. Only her laughter came back to him from the darkness. Her laughter and the low rumble of Roland's voice. He would get his own back later. He would. Time and time again, she would pay for this. In the meantime, he had to vent his feelings somehow. He turned to Sibylla. The summer was full of picnics, and for Charlie it was full of Sibylla's. But for Isabel there was only one Roland. Every day she slipped out of Charlie's sight, escaped his grasp, and disappeared on her bicycle. Charlie could never find out where the pair met, was too slow to follow her as she took flight, the bicycle wheels spinning beneath her, hair flying behind. Sometimes she would not return until darkness had fallen, sometimes not even then. When he scolded her, she laughed at him and turned her back as though he simply wasn't there. He tried to hurt her, to maim her, but as she eluded him time after time, slipping through his fingers like water, he realized how much their games had been dependent on her willingness. However great his strength, her quickness and cleverness meant she got away from him every time. Like a boar engaged by a bee, he was powerless. Once in a while, placatory, she gave in to his entreaties. For an hour or two she lent herself to his will, allowing him to enjoy the illusion that she was back for good, and that everything between them was as it always had been. But it was an illusion, as Charlie soon learned, and her renewed absence after these interludes was all the more agonizing. Charlie forgot his pain only momentarily with the Sibyllas. For a time his sister prepared the way for him. Then, as she became more and more delighted with Roland, Charlie was left to make his own arrangements. He lacked his sister's subtlety. There was an incident that could have been a scandal, and a vexed Isabel told him that if that was how he intended to go about things, then he would have to choose a different sort of woman. He turned from the daughters of minor aristocrats to those of farriers, farmers, and foresters. Personally, he couldn't tell the difference, yet the world seemed to mind less. Frequent though they were, these instances of forgetfulness were fleeting. The shocked eyes, the bruised arms, the blooded thighs were erased from memory the moment he turned away from them. Nothing could touch the great passion in his life, his feelings for Isabel. One morning, toward the end of the summer, Isabel turned the blank pages in her diary and counted the days. She closed the book and replaced it in the drawer thoughtfully. When she had decided, she went downstairs to her father's study. Her father looked up. Isabel! He was pleased to see her. Since she had taken to going out more, he was especially gratified when she came to seek him out like this. "Darling Pa," she smiled at him. He caught a glint of something in her eye. "Is there something afoot?" Her eyes travelled to a corner of the ceiling and she smiled. Without shifting her gaze from the dark corner, she told him she was leaving. At first, he hardly understood what she had said. He felt a pulse beat in his ears, his vision blurred. He closed his eyes, but inside his head there were volcanoes, meteorite strikes and explosions. When the flames died down, and there was nothing left in his inner world but a silent, devastated landscape, he opened his eyes. What had he done? In his hand was a lock of hair with a blooded clod of skin attached at one end. Isabel was there, her back to the door, her hands behind her. One beautiful green eye was bloodshot. One cheek looked red and slightly swollen. A trickle of blood crept from her scalp, reached her eyebrow, and was diverted away from her eye. He was aghast at himself and at her. He turned away from her in silence, and she left the room. Afterward, he sat for hours, twisting the auburn hair that he had found in his hand, twisting and twisting tighter and tighter around his finger until it dug deep into his skin, until it was so matted that it could not be unwound. And finally, when the sensation of pain had at last completed its slow journey from his finger to his consciousness, he cried. Charlie was absent that day and did not return home until midnight. Finding Isabel's room empty, he wandered through the house, knowing by some sixth sense that disaster had struck. Not finding his sister, he went to his father's study. One look at the grey-faced man told him everything. Father and son regarded each other for a moment, but the fact that their loss was shared did not unite them. There was nothing they could do for each other. In his room, Charlie sat on the chair next to the window, sat there for hours, a silhouette against a rectangle of moonlight. At some point, he opened a drawer and removed the gun he had obtained by extortion from a local poacher, and two or three times he raised it to his temple. Each time, the force of gravity soon returned it to his lap. At 4 o'clock in the morning, he put the gun away and took up instead the long needle that he had pilfered from the missus's sewing box a decade before and which had since seen much use. He pulled up his trouser leg, pushed his sock down, and made a new puncture mark in his skin. His shoulders shook, but his hand was steady as on his shin bone he scored a single word. Isabel. Isabel by this time was long gone. She had returned to her room for a few minutes and then left it again, taking the back stairs to the kitchen. Here she had given the missus a strange, hard hug, which was quite unlike her, and then she slipped out of the side door and darted through the kitchen garden toward the garden door, set in a stone wall. The missus's sight had been fading for a very long time, but she had developed the ability to judge people's movements by sensing vibrations in the air, and she had the impression that Isabel hesitated for the briefest of moments before she closed the garden door behind her. When it became apparent to George Angelfield that Isabel was gone, he went into his library and locked the door. He refused food, he refused visitors. There were only the vicar and the doctor to come calling now, and both of them got short shrift. "Tell your guard he can go to hell." And "let a wounded animal die in peace, won't you?" was the limit of their welcome. A few days later they returned and called the gardener to break the door down. George Angelfield was dead. A brief examination was enough to establish that the man had died from septicemia, caused by the circle of human hair that was deeply embedded in the flesh of his ring finger. Charlie did not die, though he didn't understand why not. He wandered about the house. He made a trail of footprints in the dust and followed it every day, starting at the top of the house and working down. Attic bedrooms not used for years, servants' rooms, family rooms, the study, the library, the music room, the drawing room, the kitchens. It was a restless, endless, hopeless search. At night he went out to roam the estate, his legs carrying him tirelessly forward, forward, forward. All the while he fingered the missus's needle in his pocket. His fingertips were a bloody, scabby mess. He missed Isabel. Charlie lived like this through September, October, November, December, January, and February. And at the beginning of March, Isabel returned. Charlie was in the kitchen, tracing his footsteps, when he heard the sound of hooves and wheels approaching the house. Scowling, he went to the window. He wanted no visitors. A familiar figure stepped down from the car, and his heart stood still. He was at the door, on the steps, beside the car, all in one moment, and Isabel was there. He stared at her. Isabel laughed. "Here," she said, "take this." And she handed him a heavy parcel wrapped up in cloth. She reached into the back of the carriage and took something out. "And this one." He tucked it obediently under his arm. "Now what I'd like most in the world is a very large brandy." Stunned, Charlie followed Isabel into the house and to the study. She made straight for the drinks cupboard and took out glasses and a bottle. She poured a generous slug into a glass and drank it in one go, showing the whiteness of her throat. Then she refilled her own glass and the second, which she held out to her brother. He stood there, paralyzed and speechless, his hands full with the tightly wrapped bundles. Isabel's laughter resounded about his ears again, and it was like being too close to an enormous church bell. His head started to spin, and tears sprang to his eyes. "Put them down," Isabel instructed. "We'll drink a toast." He took the glass and inhaled the spirit fumes. "To the future." He swallowed the brandy in one gulp, and coughed at its unfamiliar burn. "You haven't seen them, have you?" she asked. He frowned. "Look." Isabel turned to the parcels he had placed on the study desk, pulled the soft wrapping away, and stood back so that he could see. Slowly he turned his head and looked. The parcels were babies. Two babies. Twins. He blinked. Registered dimly that some kind of response was called for, but didn't know what he was supposed to say or do. "Oh, Charlie, wake up, for goodness sake!" And his sister took both his hands in hers and dragged him into a madcap dance around the room. She swirled him around and around and around until the dizziness started to clear his head. And when they came to a halt, she took his face in her hands and spoke to him. "Roland's dead, Charlie. It's you and me now. Do you understand?" He nodded. "Good. Now where's Pa?" When he told her, she was quite hysterical. The missus, roused from the kitchen by the shrill cries, put her to bed in her old room, and when at last she was quiet again, asked, "These babies, what are they called?" "March," Isabel responded. But the missus knew that. Word of the marriage had reached her some months before, and news of the birth. She'd not needed to count the months on her fingers, but she did it anyway and pursed her lips. She knew of Roland's death from pneumonia a few weeks ago, knew too how old Mr. and Mrs. March, devastated by the death of their only son and repelled by the fey insouciance of their new daughter-in-law, now quietly shunned Isabel and her children, wishing only to grieve. "What about Christian names?" "Adeline and Emmeline," said Isabel sleepily. "And how do you tell them apart?" But the child widow was sleeping already. And as she dreamed in her old bed, her escapade and her husband already forgotten, her virgin's name was restored to her. When she woke in the morning, it would be as if her marriage had never been. And the babies themselves would appear to her not as her own children. She had not a single maternal bone in her body, but as mere spirits of the house. The babies slept too. In the kitchen, the missus and the gardener bent over their smooth, pale faces and talked in low voices. "Which one is which?" he asked.
"I don't know."
One each side of the old crib, they watched. Two half-moon sets of lashes, two puckered mouths, two downy scalps. Then one of the babies gave a little flutter of the eyelids and half-opened one eye. The gardener and the missus held their breath. But the eye closed again, and the baby lapsed into sleep.
"That one can be Adeline," the missus whispered.
She took a striped tea towel from a drawer and cut strips from it. She plaited the strips into two lengths, tied the red one around the wrist of the baby who had stirred, the white one around the wrist of the baby who had not. Housekeeper and gardener, each with a hand on the crib, watched, until the missus turned a glad and tender face to the gardener and spoke again.
"Two babies? Honestly, Dig, at our age?"
When he raised his eyes from the babies, he saw the tears that misted her round brown eyes. His rough hand reached out across the crib. She wiped her foolishness away and, smiling, put her small, plump hand in his. He felt the wetness of her tears pressed against his own fingers. Beneath the arch of their clasped hands, beneath the trembling line of their gaze, the babies were dreaming.
It was late when I finished transcribing the story of Isabel and Charlie. The sky was dark, and the house was asleep. All of the afternoon and evening, and for part of the night, I had been bent over my desk, with the story retelling itself in my ears while my pencil scratched line after line, obeying its dictation. My pages were densely packed with script, Miss Winter's own flood of words. From time to time my hand moved to the left, and I scribbled a note in the left-hand margin, when her tone of voice or a gesture seemed to be part of the narrative itself. Now I pushed the last sheet of paper from me, set down my pencil, and clenched and stretched my aching fingers. For hours Miss Winter's voice had conjured another world, raising the dead for me, and I'd seen nothing but the puppet show her words had made. But when her voice fell still in my head, her image remained, and I remembered the grey cat that had appeared as if by magic on her lap. Silently he had sat under her stroking hand, regarding me fixedly with his round yellow eyes. If he saw my ghosts, if he saw my secrets, he didn't seem the least perturbed, but only blinked and continued to stare indifferently. "What's his name?" I had asked. "Shadow," she absently replied. At last, in bed, I turned out the light and closed my eyes. I could still feel the place on the pad of my finger where the pencil had made a groove in my skin. In my right shoulder, a knot from writing was not yet ready to untie itself. Though it was dark, and though my eyes were closed, all I could see was a sheet of paper, lines of my own handwriting with wide margins. The right-hand margin drew my attention. Unmarked, pristine, it glowed white, made my eyes sting. It was the column I reserved for my own comments, notes, and questions. In the dark, my fingers closed around a ghost pencil and twitched in response to the questions that penetrated my drowsiness. I wondered about the secret tattoo Charlie bore inside his body, his sister's name etched onto his bone. How long would the inscription have remained? Could a living bone mend itself? Or was it with him till he died? In his coffin, underground, as his flesh rotted away from the bone, was the name Isabel revealed to the darkness? Roland March, the dead husband, so soon forgotten. Isabel and Charlie. Charlie and Isabel. Who was the twins' father? And behind my thoughts, the scar on Miss Winter's palm rose into view. The letter Q for question, seared into human flesh. As I started to sleep write my questions, the margin seemed to expand, the paper throbbed with light. Swelling, it engulfed me, until I realized with a mixture of trepidation and wonderment that I was enclosed in the grain of the paper, embedded in the white interior of the story itself. Weightless, I wandered all night long in Miss Winter's story, plotting its landscape, measuring its contours, and on tiptoe at its borders, peering at the mysteries beyond its bounds. Gardens. I woke early. Too early. The monotonous fragment of a tune was scratching at my brain. With more than an hour to wait before Judith's knock at the door with breakfast, I made myself a cup of cocoa, drank it scaldingly hot, and went outdoors. Miss Winter's garden was something of a puzzle. The sheer size of it was overwhelming for a start. What I'd taken at first sight to be the border of the garden, the hedge of yew on the other side of the formal beds, was only a kind of inner wall that divided one part of the garden from another. And the garden was full of such divisions. There were hedges of hawthorn and privet and copper beech, stone walls covered with ivy, winter clematis, and the bare, scrambling stems of rambling roses and fences neatly panelled or woven in willow. Following the paths, I wandered from one section to another, but I couldn't fathom the layout. Hedges that looked solid, viewed straight on, sometimes revealed a diagonal passageway when viewed obliquely. Shrubberies were easy to wander into and near impossible to escape from. Fountains and statues that I thought I'd left well behind me reappeared. I spent a lot of time stock still, looking around me in perplexity and shaking my head. Nature had made a maze of itself and was setting out deliberately to thwart me. Turning a corner, I came across the reticent bearded man who had driven me from the station. "Maurice is what they call me," he said, reluctantly introducing himself. "How do you manage not to get lost?" I wanted to know. "Is there a trick to it?" "Only time," he said. Without looking up from his work, he was kneeling over an area of churned-up soil, levelling it and pressing the earth around the roots of the plants. Maurice, I could tell, did not welcome my presence in the garden. I didn't mind, being of a solitary nature myself. After that, I made a point, whenever I saw him, of taking a path in the opposite direction, and I think he shared my discretion. For once or twice, catching a glimpse of movement out of the corner of my eye, I glanced up to see Maurice backing out of an entrance, or making a sudden divergent turn. In this way, we successfully left each other in peace. There was ample room for us to avoid each other without any sense of constraint. Later that day, I went to Miss Winter, and she told me more about the household at Angelfield.
The name of the Mrs. was Mrs. Dunn, but to the children of the family she had always been the Mrs., and she had been in the house, it seemed, forever. This was a rarity. Staff came and went quickly at Angelfield, and since departures were slightly more frequent than arrivals, the day came when she was the only indoors servant remaining. Technically the housekeeper, in reality she did everything. She scrubbed pots and laid fires like an under-housemaid. When it was time to make a meal, she was cook, and when it was time to serve it, she was butler. Yet by the time the twins were born, she was growing old. Her hearing was poor, her sight poorer, and although she didn't like to admit it, there was much she couldn't manage. The missus knew how children ought to be brought up. Regular mealtimes, regular bedtimes, regular baths. Isabel and Charlie had grown up overindulged and neglected at the same time, and it broke her heart to see how they turned out. Their neglect of the twins was her chance, she hoped, to break the pattern. She had a plan. Under their noses, in the heart of all their chaos, she meant to raise two normal, ordinary little girls. 3 square meals a day, bedtime at 6, church on Sunday. But it was harder than she thought. For a start, there was the fighting. Adeline would fly at her sister, fists and feet flailing, yanking at her hair and landing blows wherever she could. She chased her sister, wielding red-hot coals in the fire tongs. The missus hardly knew what worried her more, Adeline's persistent and merciless aggression, or Emmeline's constant, ungrudging acceptance of it. For Emmeline, though she pleaded with her sister to stop tormenting her, never once retaliated. Instead, she bowed her head passively and waited for the blows that rained down on her shoulders and back to stop. The missus had never once known Emmeline to raise a hand against Adeline. She had the goodness of 2 children in her, and Adeline the wickedness of 2. In a way, the missus thought, it made sense. Then there was the vexed issue of food. At mealtimes, more often than not, the children simply could not be found. Emmeline adored eating, but her love of food never translated itself into the discipline of meals. Her hunger could not be accommodated by 3 meals a day. It was a ravenous, capricious thing. 10, 20, 50 times a day it struck, making urgent demands for food, and when it had been satisfied with a few mouthfuls of something, it departed and food became an irrelevance again. Emmeline's plumpness was maintained by a pocket constantly full of bread and raisins, a portable feast that she would take a bite from whenever and wherever she fancied. She came to the table only to replenish these pockets before wandering off to loll by the fire or lie in a field somewhere. Her sister was quite different. Adeline was made like a piece of wire with knots for knees and elbows. Her fuel was not the same as that of other mortals. Meals were not for her. No one ever saw her eat. Like the wheel of perpetual motion, she was a closed circuit, running on energy provided from some miraculous inner source. But the wheel that spins eternally is a myth. And when the missus noticed in the morning an empty plate, where there had been a slice of gammon the night before, or a loaf of bread with a chunk missing, she guessed where they had gone and sighed. Why wouldn't her girls eat food off a plate, like normal children? Perhaps she might have managed better if she'd been younger, or if the girls had been 1 instead of 2. But the Angelfield blood carried a code that no amount of nursery food and strict routine could rewrite. She didn't want to see it. She tried not to see it for a long time, but in the end she realized. The twins were odd. There were no 2 ways about it. They were strange all through, right into their very hearts. The way they talked, for instance. She would see them through the kitchen window, a blurred pair of forms whose mouths appeared to be moving 19 to the dozen. As they approached the house, she caught fragments of the buzz of speech. And then they came in, silent. "Speak up," she was always telling them. But she was going deaf and they were shy. Their chat was for themselves, not for others. "Don't be silly," she told Dig, when he told her the girls couldn't speak properly. "There's no stopping them when they get going." The realization came to her one day in winter. For once, both girls were indoors. Adeline had been induced by Emmeline to stay in the warmth by the fire out of the rain. Ordinarily, the missus lived in a blur of fog. On this day she was blessed by an unexpected clearing in her vision, a new sharpness of hearing, and as she passed the door of the drawing room, she caught a fragment of their noise and stopped. Sounds flew backward and forward between them, like tennis balls in some game. Sounds that made them smile or laugh or send each other malicious glances. Their voices rose in squeals and swooped down in whispers. From any distance, you'd have thought it the lively, free-flowing chatter of ordinary children. But her heart sank. It was no language she had ever heard. Not English, and not the French that she had got used to when George's Mathilde was alive, and that Charlie still used with Isabel. John was right. They didn't talk properly. The shock of understanding froze her there in the doorway. And as sometimes happens, one illumination opened the door to another. The clock on the mantelpiece chimed, and as always, the mechanism under glass sent a little bird out of a cage to flap a mechanical circuit before re-entering the cage on the other side. As soon as the girls heard the first chime, they looked up at the clock. Two pairs of wide green eyes watched, unblinking, as the bird labored around the inside of the bell, wings up, wings down, wings up, wings down. There was nothing particularly cold, particularly inhuman about their gaze. It was just the way children look at inanimate moving objects. But it froze the missus to the core. For it was exactly the same as the way they looked at her when she scolded, chided, or exhorted. "They don't realize that I am alive," she thought. "They don't know that anyone is alive but themselves." It is a tribute to her goodness that she didn't find them monstrous. Instead, she felt sorry for them. How lonely they must be. How very lonely. And she turned from the doorway and shuffled away. From that day on, the missus revised her expectations. Regular meal times and bath times, church on Sunday, two nice, normal children, all these dreams went out of the window. She had just one job now, to keep the girls safe. Turning it over in her head, she thought she understood why it was. Twins. Always together, always two. If it was normal in their world to be two, what would other people, who came not in twos but ones, seem like to them? "We must seem like halves," the missus mused. And she remembered a word, a strange word it had seemed at the time, that meant people who had lost part of themselves. Amputees. That's what we are to them. Amputees. Normal? No. The girls were not and would never be normal. But, she reassured herself, things being as they are, the twins being twins, perhaps their strangeness was only natural. Of course, all amputees hanker after the state of twinness. Ordinary people, untwins, seek their soulmate, take lovers, marry. Tormented by their incompleteness, they strive to be part of a pair. The missus was no different from anyone else in this respect. And she had her other half, John the Dig. They were not a couple in the traditional sense. They were not married. They were not even lovers. A dozen or 15 years older than he, she was not old enough to be his mother, quite, but was older than he would have expected for a wife. At the time they met, she was of an age when she no longer expected to marry anyone, while he, a man in his prime, expected to marry, but somehow never did. Besides, once he was working with the missus, drinking tea with her every morning and sitting at the kitchen table to eat her food every evening, he fell out of the habit of seeking the company of young women.
With a bit more imagination, they might have been able to leap the bounds of their own expectations. They might have recognized their feelings for what they were. Love of the deepest and most respectful kind. In another day, another culture, he might have asked her to be his wife, and she might have said yes. At the very least, one can imagine that some Friday night after their fish and mash, after their fruit pie and custard, he might have taken her hand, or she his, and they might have led each other in bashful silence to one or other of their beds. But the thought never entered their heads. So they became friends, the way old married couples often do, and enjoyed the tender loyalty that awaits the lucky on the other side of passion, without ever living the passion itself. His name was John the Dig, John Digence to those who didn't know him. Never a great one for writing, once the school years were past, and they were soon past, for there were not many of them. He took to leaving off the last letters of his surname to save time. The first three letters seemed more than adequate. Did they not say who he was, what he did, more succinctly, more accurately even than his full name? And so he used to sign himself John Dig, and to the children he became John the Dig. He was a colourful man, blue eyes like pieces of blue glass with the sun behind, white hair that grew straight up on top of his head like plants reaching for the sun, and cheeks that went bright pink with exertion when he was digging. No one could dig like him. He had a special way of gardening, with the phases of the moon, planting when the moon was waxing, measuring time by its cycles. In the evening he pored over tables of figures, calculating the best time for everything. His great-grandfather gardened like that, and his grandfather and his father.